Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Adam Coleman, welcoming you to a new season of The Cosmic Library, the show about infinite reading that really doesn't require too much time. Our seasons until now have followed conversations prompted by some colossal work, Finnegan's Wake, The Thousand and One Nights. But this season, we're doing something a little different and a little the same. There's still an infinite literary subject prompting us, but it's an entire category of writing. This season, we're talking about short stories in the United States. So again, in some ways, this isn't so different from earlier seasons in which books brought together a multitude of narratives. But in other ways, this is so fundamentally and kind of obviously different. American short stories are so multitudinous from so many different writers doing so many different things. A show trying to encompass that subject can only be incomplete, can only fail in a way. This brings me back to the challenge of every season of The Cosmic Library. There's never in any of these seasons a way in which I can completely or accurately figure out its prompting literary subject, whether that's Finnegan's Wake or 1001 Nights or the Bible or Journey to the West. Same goes for the subject of short stories in the United States. And the point of The Cosmic Library has never been to decode or resolve or explain away its subjects anyway. It's to let literary infinity awaken new thoughts, new conversations, realizations, recognitions. And so here we're going to give our attention to the short story. And in fact, I have found out that there are certain things that can be said and can be figured out about the short story. I spoke with Deborah Treisman, the New Yorker fiction editor, who for years has brought short stories to vast audiences through both the New Yorker magazine and the immortal New Yorker fiction podcast. What do you find to be the difference between a short story and just a short version of a novel? Is there a difference? Or is a short story simply fiction that's short?
I think there's a big difference, really, in terms of what you're trying to capture and how quickly you're trying to get there and how complicated it can be. They're different forms. There doesn't have to be a radical difference in the style the writing takes, but the roadmap is so different and the ability to take detours is so different. There are short story writers who essentially are writing tiny novels. You know, Alice Munro is probably the master of that, where she jumps, you know, decades. And in the novel, you would have to fill in those decades, whereas in the short story, you really don't. It's a kind of jumping in and out of a life rather than telling the whole story of a life.
Here's The Washington Post critic Becca Rothfeld. She's the author of a book in praise of excess and maximalism, a book called All Things Are Too Small. You might think short stories would have no place in a conversation with an author of such a book, but not so.
I mean, I do have a personal prejudice in favor not only of novels, but in favor of long novels. I love encyclopedic novels like Brilliant Alexander plots. But I do think that a short story can be luxurious because I don't think I'm defining maximalism in my book just as bigness. It's more about gratuity and sumptuousness. I actually, before we started recording, I made a list of short stories that I do think are kind of luxurious and that they're full of gratuities or they're maximalist in some sense, even if they're not long. So Kafka, a lot of Kafka short stories, I think, gesture at or describe sort of nightmarish geographies or architectures that seem like they extend infinitely or that invoke a specter of infinite regression. So like Before the Law is a really short Kafka short story, basic, almost just an aphorism. And yet he invokes this structure in which the law is an infinite regression of gatekeepers at what seems like an infinite number of doors. And so there's an infinity enfolded into that story, even though it's very short. Or another of my favorite short stories is called Sounds by Vladimir Nabokov. And it's just a really sensually luxurious story with lots of really beautiful prose and lots of really ornate descriptions and a lot of sensory detail. Another person who writes a lot of short fiction that I love is the German romantic Heinrich von Kleist. And so I guess Michael Kohlhaas is a novella. It's not a short story, but it is an account of someone who just goes on a rampage, someone who reacts really disproportionately to a slight and who goes on a campaign for vengeance that's really excessive. There's some bureaucratic problem that he encounters. I won't go into the details of it because it's set in like Renaissance era Germany, so it's complicated. But the way he responds to this is by burning tons of towns and gathering an army of people to stage an insurrection. So even though that's a very short, slim book, it's obviously an account of excess and disproportion. Those are some examples.
When I spoke with the Oxford scholar Andrew Kahn, author of the short story, A Very Short Introduction, the history of the short story as a form seemed to be maximalist, seemed to sprawl. It's related to the history of commerce, technology, media, literacy.
By and large, the creation and the rise of the modern short story is traditionally seen as a 19th century phenomenon linked to growth in readerships in certain countries, and probably most enduringly in Anglophone countries. You could talk about the United States, Great Britain, Ireland as well, Australia. It's in the Anglophone countries and in the US, most especially, that we see the short story flourish. And I think the growth of the US into a continental empire, you know, the short story sort of tracks the country's expansion, its growth into a continental empire, increasing urbanization, because literature readers tend to be, well, either they access literature through print subscription in the 19th century, or they're city dwellers. Over the course of the century, this is true in the USA, it was also true in Russia, you know, also an enormous country with a growing reading public, the cost of paper and print went down. So we see the circulation of newspapers and weeklies enjoying a huge growth, which is facilitated by the expansion of transport networks, by water and rail. And this means that you can deliver copy, you know, you can satisfy demand. So there's a newfound appetite for stories that overlaps with a new capacity to supply texts. And so well into the 1940s and 1950s, all sorts of newspapers, all sorts of magazines and also newspapers continue to reserve space for short fiction, increasingly quality fiction, and the short story, particularly in the higher quality journals, magazines, are seen as marks of prestige.
So let's turn to a writer from this mid-20th century world. I spoke with the novelist Tayari Jones, author of An American Marriage, about Diane Oliver, a mid-century writer whose short fiction has recently been collected into a book called Neighbors, for which Jones has written the introduction.
If I know you and I have not given you a copy of this book, it means I don't like you, because I'm giving this book to everyone.
There's a lot to say about Diane Oliver and her stories.
You know, Diane Oliver was born in Charlotte, North Carolina, and she was a student at the Iowa Writers' Workshop in the early 1960s. She's African American, getting an MFA, you know, in the 60s. Like now the MFA is a pretty ubiquitous part of the writing landscape. But in the 60s, to get an advanced degree in creative writing was an unusual move for a writer in general, but for an African American woman, you know, this was kind of unheard of. And she published a couple of stories while she was in graduate school and was really on her way. And then right before graduation, just a few days before graduation, she was killed in a motorcycle accident. She was only 22 years old. Her stories never appeared before now as a book. So I think she fell under the radar because she was kind of cut off before her time.
In Oliver's stories, you find a kind of attention and narrative artistry that brings you back to that mid-century moment in new ways.
the turns of the plots are so surprising. Like the title story, Neighbors, is about a family who's about to send their little boy to integrate the local elementary school. And, you know, you imagine Ruby Bridges, so adorable in her pinafore, you know, facing down all the hatred to go to school in New Orleans. And we really kind of romanticize that image of the little child carrying the moral weight of the nation. Well, in this story, the family, yes, the Black family agreed to send their child to the white school. However, when they signed up, the other people in their neighborhood, their neighbors, had agreed to send their children too. But now the day has come and their little boy is going to be the only one. And the family has to really decide if they want to put their five-year-old or six-year-old through this. These stories gave a different kind of insight into these dilemmas. These stories presented as a dilemma. Because here, comfortable in the future, we don't see it as a dilemma because we know the benefit of these brave children who integrated these schools. The fact that it is for the absolute good is clear to us today, but you know, you're looking at it, you know, you're staring it in the eye in 1958, and that's something someone would need to think about.
It's a story that takes you to that particular point in time, in a particular place. Short stories have, according to Andrew Kahn, especially fixed on that kind of super local specificity.
Short stories have been crucial to American literature also because the genre tends to be highly local. That's not surprising if you think about newspapers, local newspapers. And this is a point that Frank O'Connor, the Irish writer, great writer of short stories, makes in his wonderful study of the genre, The Solitary Voice. And he makes a point about the need to think about the short story as rooted in local culture, customs, regional identities. So in a country as large as the USA, with many different regional identities and mixed populations, the story has kept its vitality and relevance because I think it's owned by no one group or by no single literary establishment. I think that we see short story writers who, because they're regional, with a great ear for speech, they're sort of like anthropologists of the customs and rituals of their own local worlds, whether they're observing courtesies and class-based behavior of the South, which is what you find on the pages of Eudora Welty, or the habits of the old world brought into the new, which you might find tracked by Bernard Malamud or Isaac Bashevis Singer in New York and in Jewish Eastern European communities in New York and Florida. I think if we think about the present moment, you might ask, what is a New York story or even a New Yorker short story these days? And it seems to me this short story intersects with many ethnic groups in different worlds. You've got the Hispanic world of Juno Diaz, the Russian emigre world of someone like Lara Vapnyar, the Haitian emigre experience of Edwige Dantecat. They all reflect the different microcosms to be found in one great city. And these stories are, of course, available to multiple readerships across the US and across the Anglophone world. I have a subscription to The New Yorker, even though I live in Oxford, UK. It may be a bit fanciful to think that stories of the colonial and pioneer experience written when settlers were foreigners look ahead to the experiences of immigrants to America nowadays. But somehow there seems to be a continuity of spirit and openness, evidence in how permanent short stories have been as a genre in American culture above all.
That range brings us to the main challenge of this season. The American short story covers so much that it doesn't really hold together as a simple category. Here's Deborah Treisman.
I feel like the term itself, American short story, is slightly problematic just because there are so many people in the U.S. writing short stories who perhaps came from somewhere else, who, you know, have a different heritage. Whatever else it is, they're not, you know, playing into this tradition of Updike and Cheever and so on and what you think of as the American short story. So I feel as though what's around right now is such multiplicity that it's rare to find a story that you would think of as classically American.
With Americanness so wide-ranging that it's kind of indefinable, it seems like it can arise in literature especially as an object of inquiry, something to question, something to wonder about. Here's the writer Justin Taylor, whose latest novel, Reboot, tells a story of mass media and internet-addled America.
One quality of American literature is it's really obsessed with its own Americanness in a way that I don't think a lot of other national literatures are. You talk about German literature, like it has certain characteristics, I think, and you can sort of stereotype or generalize about the, you know, the German people or the German character. But the literature itself is not taking Germanness as its primary subject matter most of the time, where I think so much of American literature is really about its own Americanness. And it's really inward looking and kind of not maybe narcissistic in a certain way. But it also just assumes that the question is so broad and endlessly answerable that's part of what makes it a fit subject. I mean, this is like half of Whitman, right? You know, he's constantly sort of theorizing what it is to be an American, what it is to, you know, be America, what the American project is. And there's just kind of endless iterations of that down the ages. I mean, you know, even I think about, you know, someone like Barry Hanna. I mean, he is such a product of place, culture, and time, which is to say, you know, a guy born in Mississippi right around the middle of the century who lived his, you know, almost his entire life in the South. And he was like a bit of a hippie and a bit of a greaser and a bit of a good old boy and, you know, a bit of a genius. The thing that he does is not doable anywhere else, I think. Whereas Middlemarch or Dickens or something, like those books are very English. They're English to their bones. But I think you could write The Great Expectations of, you know, South Korea or, you know, the Middlemarch of Iceland, which to my mind just is Halldór Laxness's Independent People. I mean, that's basically what that book is. And so, you know, I know it's kind of reproducible in that way, at least. But man, I don't think you could have an Icelandic Barry Hanna because there's something just so American about the set of assumptions and biases and motives that make him write in the first place. I don't think you would get that anywhere else.
To go back to another American short story writer, to Diane Oliver, we see very American historical circumstances of the 1950s turn to a private scene of thought and uncertainty that might lead the reader to think still more about a historical moment. Here's Tyari Jones.
This is near the very end of Neighbors. The older sister is observing her parents as there is time to wake the little boy up to take him to school. "He's our child," she heard her mother say. "Whatever we do, we're going to be the cause." Her father had pushed the cup away from him and sat with his hands covering part of his face. Outside, Ellie could hear a horn blowing. "God knows we tried, but I guess there's just no use." Her father's voice forced her attention back to the two people sitting in front of her. "Maybe when things come back to normal, we'll try again." He covered his wife's chunky fingers with the palm of his hand, and her mother seemed to be enveloped in silence. The three of them remained quiet, each involved in his own thoughts, but related, Ellie knew, to the same thing. She was the first to break the silence. "Mama," she called after a long pause, "do you want me to start setting the table for breakfast?" Her mother nodded. Ellie turned the clock so she could see it from the sink while she washed the dishes that had been scattered over the floor. "You gonna wake Tommy up? You want me to?" "No," her mother said, still holding her father's hand. "Let him sleep." I mean, just the emotion there. I mean, they're down to the wire. The people are coming to pick their child up, to take him to this uncharted territory. And the mother says, "Whatever happens, we are going to be the cause. We are his parents before we are anything else." That is such a radical idea, particularly when you think about, you know, one thing she does here, the role of children in the civil rights movement. I mean, so many people sacrificed their children. You know, you think about the children in Birmingham that were all arrested, the school children who were arrested and put in pens in Birmingham. You think about Little Ruby Bridges, you think about the Little Rock Nine, all of that. And that part of it, I don't think is really discussed in public.
Here's Deborah Treisman speaking about what the best short stories might do.
Yeah, I mean, short stories, good short stories make the reader do some work. Good novels do, too. I mean, even if you get all the colors of the rainbow, you still have to fill in the sky behind it. I mean, there's a way of writing that's just when I see a story that doesn't work, often it's a matter of overtelling. And if you tell the reader everything and the reader has nothing to do, the reader will get bored. So I think the trick of figuring out what to say and what to allow the reader to extrapolate, it's quite hard, you know, and it's often a stumbling block for writers. But the best stories really make you fill in the gaps, fill in those missing decades.
The shortness of short stories can explain how this works. Because of their brevity, they necessarily leave so much for the reader to spell out. Here's Andrew Kahn on that brevity and on the focus of short stories.
I think short stories are essentially brief encounters with felt life. They have a unity of purpose in their use of voice, setting, and plot, and that gives them their psychological depth and sometimes their drama. They can't stray too far from the single fate, the single story, the single personality. I think it's the point that Flannery O'Connor, great Southern Gothic, Southern Christian writer, or just great writer, makes about the point of view in telling. She has really interesting comment in a letter, and she says you need to get into a character's mind to give the story a dramatic unity that's hard to get otherwise. If you violate the point of view, she says, you destroy the sense of reality and louse yourself up, meaning you louse yourself up as a writer. A single focus dominates the short story. It can be a dramatic episode, a moment in time, a mood, a place, a relationship. Whereas, of course, the novel will multiply all of that and have to create a much larger architecture in which to correlate all of those relations. This isn't to say that stories, while being linear, cannot move back and forward in time. They can also have secondary characters who can be side-shadowed. They have, you know, backstory can be hinted at. Flashbacks can be used. Landscape and setting can be evoked to achieve particular effects. But ultimately, the short stories are most successful when they create a memorable record of a single experience.
Becca Rothfeld explains how smallness can still have something to do with richness, with excess.
The way that I define excess is as something gratuitous, something that's more than or additional to what you might need. And so maybe not all of those things are physically large, or if we're talking about literature or a movie, might not have a long runtime or be many pages, but more than one needs. It's an argument in favor of more than one needs. So some of the things that I argue in favor of are clutter, having lots of objects in your house, not necessarily buying lots of objects, but having a house full of personal effects, personal heirlooms, against Marie Kondo types. I argue against not all fragment novels, but a certain kind of trendy fragment novel, which feels very denuded and sparse.
One way short stories lead us into excess is in their emanation from a deep, many-layered history of narrative making. Here's Andrew Kahn.
For storytelling practices and values that bear a closer resemblance and affinity that look recognizable to readers of the modern short story, I think it's fairly standard to look back to the Renaissance, which is the moment when literature began to acquire new techniques that made narratives more complex. Very important here is the idea of the short story or the story of storytelling as entertainment. So I think it's the Renaissance, that seems to be the moment when stories from far-flung parts of the globe, such as India, the Middle East, they made their way into French and Latin translations. They crisscrossed the medieval and modern world, kind of piggybacking on crusaders, merchants, or being transported by crusaders, merchants, and pilgrims. So, of course, a really important model for 18th century storytellers across Europe, but especially in France, was the French translation of 1001 Nights.
Reading in pursuit of entertainment, of some kind of enjoyment, some curiosity about what comes next and next and then next. This is a fundamental part of Deborah Treisman's editorial consideration of short stories for The New Yorker.
The first read is just a read. I'm just reading and seeing if I want to keep going and want to get to the end and seeing what it does to me as a reader. So that's completely pretty much unadulterated by other considerations. Then if I'm working on a story, then I go much deeper into it. You know, then I have to think about if each paragraph is doing what it needs to do and so on. And I can also find much more admiration for a story when I'm editing it and thinking in those terms, because I suddenly see things that I didn't notice on that first read, which was, I guess you'd call a pleasure read, right?
And then pleasure has its place, too, in the bigger commercial history of the short story. Here's Andrew Kahn.
One of the things that facilitates or makes the short story possible and attracts gifted authors to the short stories is that, at least in this period, because newspapers and magazines will pay for copy, is that the short story is a good little money earner. Even Chekhov, we think of Chekhov, Anton Chekhov, as someone who's, you know, a bit detached from material concerns, but you find in his letters to his publishers, one publisher in particular, an eye for business, a real pragmatism about how his stories will be serialized and then published in book form. And I think that's fairly typical.
And if we think of regularly released short stories as opportunities for excess, for continually published entertainment, we should also think of the connection to literature of weirdness and thrill. It's not a coincidence, as we'll discuss this season, that one of the modern short story's original creators is Edgar Allan Poe. Here's Justin Taylor on weird fiction.
This goes all the way back to Freud, like, you know, his definition of the uncanny in that essay as, you know, something sort of simultaneously familiar and unfamiliar, or finding the alien at the heart of the known, or the known at the heart of the, you know, the strange, right? I mean, he always, you know, he talks about the better translation of the word is unhomely, and homely in its sense of like the things of the home. I just think the short story is a very good vehicle for that, because it can set a lot of things in motion, establish a set of guidelines very quickly, and then radically alter the terms of what it's doing. You know, so like E.T.A. Hoffman's The Sandman, you know, which is of course a big text for Freud, like that does that a few times. There's a few kind of big reversals and moments when you feel like the narrative ground is being ripped out from under you. That's often the case with Poe too. There's a great Thomas Ligotti quote. The thing about Edgar Allan Poe's story is that all his stories are about abysses, and the shape of the abyss is the shape of the story itself. And so you're in a world kind of without any firm narrative ground on which to stand. And that's just a really hard thing to sustain. I mean, people have tried, I suppose, with greater or less success. For me, I think the brevity is part of the intensity. It's part of the pleasure.
Stories, these very small things, can send you all over the place, including into infinite abysses or into an overloaded world, a shaky world, a world of clutter and contradictory feelings and thoughts and maximalism. Here's Becca Rothfeld with A Dream of Maximalism, reading from her new book, All Things Are Too Small.
I dream of a house stuffed floor to ceiling, rooms so overfull they prevent entry. Too many books for the shelves, fictions brimming with facts, but more importantly, flush with form. Long tomes and too many volumes, sentences that swerve on for pages. Clauses like jewels strung onto necklaces, a kitchen crammed with cream, melting butter, sweating cheese. Clothes on the floor, shoes on the bed, blood rested on the sheets, mud looming all the carpets, and a table set for a banquet bigger than I could ever host. I want all this precisely because I do not need it.
Thank you for listening to the Cosmic Library season on the short story in the U.S. We are brought to you by LitHub. Our guests this season include Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker and host of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, Tayari Jones, author of An American Marriage, Becca Rothfeld, Washington Post book critic whose new book is All Things Are Too Small, Andrew Kahn, author of the short story A Very Short Introduction, Justin Taylor, author of Reboot, and the actor Max Gordon Moore, from whom you have yet to hear, but who will read in its entirety Nathaniel Hawthorne's brilliantly weird story, Wakefield, in the next episode. Here's Hawthorne.
Who could have anticipated that our friend would entitle himself to a foremost place among the doers of eccentric deeds?
I'm Adam Coleman. Thank you again for listening.